Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, 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 everyone. Today's guest is a well-known UFO investigator who has significant experience in researching a wide variety of aspects of the mystery. Mr. Jeremy McGowan is the United States Air Force veteran and a pioneer of customizing the world's first mobile UAP tracker device called, vehicle called OSIRIS. Jeremy has appeared alongside the former ATIP director Lou Elizondo on the hit TV show from the History Channel, Unidentified: Inside America's UFO Investigation. Jeremy, welcome to Shifting the Paradigm.
Thank you. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here. I appreciate it very much.
Me too. I'm really excited. I'm looking forward to this. So let's jump right into the deep end and let's talk about what makes you tick in regards to your passion for this topic, the UAP topic. So much so that you would work so hard in creating OSIRIS. I feel like it's like your second baby.
Third, technically. what makes me tick and why the passion? Primarily, and I don't want to take too much of a serious tone here, but that's exactly what happened. Like you said, I was in the military for 12 years. And during that entire time, I spent the vast majority of my time pointing the dangerous end of weapons at dangerous people. And it was during my deployment in 1995 when I was in Jordan, when I had my sighting. And my mentality, my default state, always goes to what is it and how can I defend against it? Because I just think primarily for the most part that things are inherently dangerous. If we don't understand them, if we don't know how they function, they pose a threat. So having a wife and two daughters, my mentality just goes to how do I keep my family safe? And nobody had answers. Nobody knew what they were. Nobody still knows what they are. So I just set about going after this my own way because I wasn't satisfied with the information and the data that was being presented to me. And I wanted to find out if this is something that I need to defend my family against.
Wow. And so talking about your experience in the military, when you were serving in the Middle East, you talked about that you saw something that changed your life in Jordan. Right. Do you want to talk about that? Kind of give an explanation?
Yeah, absolutely. It's and I don't know how much detail you want me to go into. Fair enough. So basically, I still don't know what it was that I saw. But I've had this story vetted by Lou Elizondo, the entire production team behind History Channel's Unidentified: Inside America's UFO Investigation TV show vetted it. I've had Lieutenant Tim McMillan look into it, and everybody has come back with, yes, this was a legitimate thing that you were involved in. So basically, this was in 1995, and this would have been roughly 4 years after the fall of the Soviet Empire. And I don't know how much you or your listeners know about the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, but when they fell apart overnight, there was multiple nation states that were created within a 24-hour period. And a lot of these new countries, new nation states, had the arsenal, the nuclear arsenal from the former Soviet Empire. There was countries that sprang up with no history, no regulations, no internal laws or governance, and they have a stockpile of nuclear weapons. And a lot of these weapons went missing. I think John Deutsch, the director of National Intelligence, stated that there was probably over 600 at that time nuclear warheads or nuclear weapons that had gone missing. And my deployment, unbeknownst to me at the time, when I was in the Air Force, I was sent from Pope Air Force Base with a with nine other people deployed to the country of Jordan. And I had already spent an inordinate amount of time in the Middle East during Desert Storm. So this was not something, this was not something that was completely new to me. I knew the Middle East like the back of my hand by this time. So when I got to Jordan, the ops tempo, the operational tempo, the type of people that I had deployed with and everything around there was certainly not an exercise per se. It was absolutely a real world, you know, boots on the ground and everybody having a pucker factor type of feeling. And I didn't realize it at the time, but, my duty was to guard this crate, this giant wooden crate in the middle of the Jordanian desert. I had no SOPs, standard operating procedures. I had no rules of engagement. I was just told not to let anybody near this crate. And I was there for several days, several nights, actually.
So you had no idea what was in the crate?
None whatsoever. I was just told not to get near the crate and don't let anybody else get near the crate.
So no other context. Like, so who was the person giving those orders?
Just some random brass. I don't remember if it was a captain or a major in the Air Force. We got on site. And I say we because it was myself and one other individual. We got out there and we were just told, this is your duty. Keep people away from this crate. And I had made the question. I was like, well, what happens if somebody gets near the crate? And they were like, don't let them near the crate. I was like, well, I'll ask it again. What happens if somebody gets near the crate? Shoot them.
Oh my gosh. Well, Buck is saying that he loves this story. I always wonder what the final destination of the crate was. I mean, me too. Do you happen to know what it is, Jeremy?
Well,
where it went?
I have supposition on what the crate is. I think I know where the crate ended up. But I'll get to that part in a second. But going back to the don't get near the crate part, I mean, when I'm 24, 25 years old and I'm an E3 or an E4 in the Air Force and have zero supervision, you know, the last thing that we do is what we're supposed to do. So I got on the crate. I laid on the crate. I sat on the crate. I peed on the crate. I did everything that you're not supposed to do to that crate. And back then, I was a heavy, heavy smoker. I probably smoked about two packs a day. And you can't smoke on post because the little cherry on the end of your cigarette will give your position away in night vision goggles. It looks like a giant neon billboard. So I would walk about anywhere between, say, 100 meters to 300 meters away from the crate and climb up on a sand dune where I could still see it at night and light up a cigarette. And this one night, I just happened to take out my night vision goggles and put my night vision goggles on while I was smoking a cigarette on the sand dune. And I looked up in the stars, and I don't know if you've ever seen through night vision goggles before, but the amount of stars that you can see is amplified exponentially. Imagine the most beautiful clear night in the world that you've ever seen. And then amplify that or multiply that by a factor of 1,000. You can see every star that you've never seen before in your life. So I'm just mesmerized and looking up, and you know, we're in the middle of the Jordanian desert. We're not in a flight pattern. We're probably in a restricted airspace. There's been nothing, nobody flying around or anything like that. And the next thing I know, I'm seeing through my field of vision in the night vision goggles, this singular pinpoint of light that is a magnitude brighter than any of the other stars. It comes from my 6 o'clock position behind me, shoots up directly top dead center, and makes a 90 degree left hand turn and shoots off to my 9 o'clock position with absolutely zero depreciation in speed. There was no radius. There was no arc. There was no hesitation. It just made a perfect 90 degree angle, horizon to horizon. And traveled horizon to horizon in just a matter of seconds. And then I saw it again. And then I saw it again. And it just repeated this over and over again. And I took off my night vision goggles and I gave it to the other guy that was with me, and he didn't say anything, but after a few minutes I could see his head just kind of shoot down and then turn. And I knew at that minute that he had seen it, and he just took the goggles off and handed it back to me and took a drag of a cigarette, threw it out and walked back to post and never said anything else about it. So for 24 years, I've been questioning what the hell it was that I saw. And it's not like I could go to my commanding officer at the time and say, hey, you know, while I was guarding this potential nuclear weapon that I'm not supposed to know about, I happened to walk off post to go have a cigarette. So I couldn't say anything to anybody. I couldn't bring it up. I couldn't ask any questions. So it was something that just got into my brain as kind of a brain worm and stayed there for 24 years until a series of events led me to become on the TV show and be interviewed by Lou. And during that interview, Lou had to ask me very, very pointedly. He asked me if I had thought that it was one craft that was repeating a pattern, or if I thought that it was multiple craft that was following the same pattern. And up until that point, I had never even considered that it was more than one. So when he asked me that kind of made me sit up and think about things.
So talking about that TV show, how did Lou find you? How did he find your story to be on his show?
Man, social media is insane. So I had been divorced recently at that point in time. And I was sitting on my sofa probably about 3 o'clock in the morning, having a pity party for myself. And I was watching TV and I saw a random episode of season one of that show on. And that triggered every single memory that I had about this event from back in Jordan. So I was thinking to myself, how can I prove that this happened? And if you remember, there was a guy with me, but I don't know who it was. I don't remember his name, his rank, what base he was from, or anything. So I went on Reddit, because Reddit is full of internet detectives. If you want to know anything about anybody, post on Reddit and they will tell you what the guy's blood type is and you know what color his hair. It's insane.
Absolutely. I love it.
So I think at the time I went on to a veteran sub forum and I was looking for people to see if they could track down the guy that was with me. They didn't, strangely enough, but everybody started telling me to post it in the UFO subreddit. So I did that. And then the comments on the UFO subreddit were, hey, you know, if you've ever seen this TV show Unidentified, if you pause it at the very end, there's an email address and they're looking for military folks to tell their story. And I had only seen that one episode at that point in time. So I went back and I watched another episode of the show and I saw the email and I paused it and I basically cut and pasted the story that I had put on Reddit into an email for the TV show, and nothing happened. I mean, it was probably a series of 6 or 8 weeks had gone by and nothing, no response. And then out of the blue, I get a phone call from Jessica Phillips, who was an executive producer with A&E Networks. And she was like, hey, Mr. McGowan, we really love your story. And we were wondering if you'd be willing to tell it on camera. And I'm like, maybe, I don't know. Can you guys maybe help track down the guy that was with me? Because I'm still in the process of trying to validate my own memory. And she had told me that they would put their people on it and researching and they would vet out the story. And I still wasn't even convinced that I was going to go on air and tell this. They flew me to New York. I walked into the studio that they were filming this in, and there's Lou Elizondo. I only knew him from season one. I was never a UFO guy. I never went down this rabbit hole. I had never read any books on UFOs or anything. So the only thing that I knew about Lou was from watching season one. That was it. But as soon as I walked into the studio, Lou and I think the guy's name was Matt Thompson, which was one of the camera guys or one of the on-site producers. Everybody was so professional. Nobody snickered. Nobody laughed. Everybody took me very seriously. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll tell the story. So, and that's since then, everything has snowballed. I've been on, holy cow, 12 or 13 podcasts. I got involved in a movie production with Sean Cahill and Lou Elizondo, and I've built this vehicle to help me find the answers that nobody seems to have. But
so let's go back. Hold on, before you keep going, because you're hitting so many great points. So let's go back before we even hit the car. What movie were you in?
So I wasn't in a movie. I was in a movie production. No, that's fine. Basically, what had happened is I had started doing these podcasts and I had started building my vehicle, the Osiris, and I had launched my own Twitter page. And I think at the time I maybe have had 300 or 400 people following me on Twitter, but I was posting pictures of the Osiris and the build and the sensors getting integrated into the vehicle. And the next thing I know, Jake Mann from It's Redacted had reached out to me and said, "Man, I love what you're doing with the vehicle and everything. I think we could make a movie about this." I'm like, "Okay, let's talk about it." And he's like, "We don't have to do anything grand. We just use some iPhones and some GoPros. I'm a producer, so we can make this work." I'm like, "Okay, let's do it." So Jake and I started talking, and then a couple weeks go by, and the podcast "I Believe in Humans" with Justin Tandy and Dustin Hoyer reached out to me and invited me on their podcast. And then at the end, as you know, when the podcasts are over, you have an informal off the record conversation and things like that. And Justin and Dustin were saying, "Hey, just to let you know, we're directors of photography and directors, and we have some camera equipment. We were thinking maybe we could do a movie with you." And I'm like, "Well, I'm kind of doing something with Jake. But when you say you have camera equipment, what do you guys have?" And they're like, "Oh, well, we've got cinemagraphic camera equipment." I'm like, "Well, what does that mean?" They're like, "Well, we have a couple Red Epics," which they're like, $350,000 movie cameras. And I'm like, "Holy cow." So I put Jake and Dustin in contact. I'm sorry, Justin and Dustin in contact with Jake. And now I've got a producer and two directors and everything is coming to play. And during that whole time, I'm in conversations with Sean Cahill. Sean and I were developing a friendship, and we'd been in, we were having, hour long conversations 2 or 3 times a week about the phenomenon and what it was and how to look for it and things like that. And Sean was starting to work on a project with Lou. And then, I just told Sean, I was like, "Hey, I've got a director, I've got a producer, I've got two Red Epics, and we've got this vehicle that I've built, and we're going to make a movie." And Sean's just like, "Well, hey, let's get Lou involved in this, because I'm working with Lou on this big media push that Lou's going to go into." So the next thing you know, Sean is flying from LA to here where I'm at in Vegas. And he and I drive from Vegas with a car full of camera equipment, mic'd up, and go to Lou Elizondo's house. And I end up spending a week at Lou's house. The directors and the producers meet us up there, and we shoot for 4 days up at Lou's house. And we put together a fantastic proof of concept for this show, or movie, or whatever it was going to be that was coming out. Jake and Justin and Dustin put together an amazing visual representation of the 4 days that we spent up there. But I have since pulled out of the project with Lou and Sean. I wish them the absolute best. It was just a challenging conflict of certain interests and certain personalities up there. And I just decided that myself and the Osiris would probably be better served going back to grassroots and doing things low key and low budget and presenting data and information to the world as I can create it. So, and that's kind of where I'm at now.
Wow. So very genuine, very like down to earth concepts, seems like. So for this movie production, that when was this taking place? Like, how long ago was this?
Oh, just a few months ago. I mean, we're talking. Yeah, I was up in at Lou's house and we were doing the filming in January of this year.
Wow, that's insane. So then, about Osiris. So you're taking him on your own, or is it a her? Is it him or her?
It's an it, I think. I don't think we've had a gender reveal party for the vehicle yet, so I'm not sure if the smoke's going to be pink or blue. It burns a lot of oil, so it's probably going to be blue smoke. So let's call it a guy. It'll be a he.
All right.
Sorry.
No, it's funny. I guess I'm just so used to having people name their cars. My dad was like that. I'm like that. So I just assumed, and I'm so sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, if it's not something important to me, I never put any thought into it. So I have no idea, but yeah, let's call it a guy. It's the Osiris. I think that was probably a very masculine god of the Egyptian times. So let's go with that.
There you go. It already has a name, but it also stands for something. What does it stand for?
Off-Road Scientific Investigation and Response Informatics System. Yes, it's a backronym. So I came up with the name Osiris first and then figured out what it was going to stand for based on what it was doing. And it's built on the platform from a 1999 Land Rover Discovery, which is probably, even to this day, one of the most capable off-road vehicles ever created, with power windows and air conditioning. It is comfortable to drive over terrain that is brutally unforgiving. And I've upgraded the suspension and done a lot of work to the vehicle to lift it and give it a lot more capability. But one of the reasons that I made it made the Osiris is because the sensor stack that I've adopted initially is the SkyHub sensor stack, which incorporates machine learning and artificial intelligence and camera analytics and all sorts of other sensors and platforms to specifically detect incidents of UAP, to try to identify them or compare them to known flight patterns or flight paths of conventional aircraft. But I live in Las Vegas, which is one of the brightest cities in the entire world. We have every single light bulb ever made is here in Las Vegas. So I didn't feel that that searching the night sky here would be very, very beneficial. So I figured that, taking this and putting it in my vehicle would be the right approach, because now I can go out into Death Valley or go into Rachel, Nevada, or park at the back door of Area 51 and turn this thing on and see what I can find. So it just became a very off-road scientific investigation vehicle. And I was like, well, it needs a name. So the Osiris was born.
So how long did it take to create it, to rebuild it?
God, I'm still working on it. I'm still working on it. This thing's 22 years old. So if I'm not turning wrenches and changing the oil and upgrading the suspension, it will fall apart. And I'm not easy on this thing. I mean, I've had it airborne hitting bumps and dips and everything. As a matter of fact, Dustin Hoyer of I Believe in Humans was in the back seat when we were filming in Wyoming, and I hit a bump so hard that the back end of the vehicle left the ground, and Dustin just about bit his tongue off. He bloodied his tongue severely, because when his head hit the roof of the vehicle, he bit his tongue. I'm not easy on the vehicle. I'm not easy on it at all, but it's a very, very capable platform.
So I guess my question is, when did you start building on it, and how long has it been since then, even though you're still working on this?
You know, it was late last year when I started building on this thing. Well, let's say mid last year. And it was just a serendipitous event. I was doing a podcast with Dead Hand Radio, Andrew Hall. And Andrew had asked me a question about what I thought was necessary in ufology or in UAP research. And I don't remember exactly the words that I used to answer the question, but I told him, paraphrasing from memory, is that I thought we needed standardization in data gathering. We needed a very specific way that everybody could do the exact same type of investigations and standardize the output so that there would be a commonality between everything. So when research was initiated on the output, everybody knew what to expect. And Andrew had asked me at that point if I had ever heard about SkyHub. And I hadn't, because if you remember, I wasn't a UFO guy. I wasn't in this world. So I had never heard of SkyHub. But while he was talking to me on this podcast, I hopped on my other monitor here and Googled them and saw what they were and pulled it up. And I think by the end of the week, I was probably ordering parts for building the SkyHub. And as I was building it, right here on my desk, as a matter of fact, this is a little tiny monitor that I had, that I was using for, testing it. And, as I was building this thing, I just decided that, you know, that'd be a great time to start incorporating it into the vehicle.
And where has it been and what have you seen with that, with Osiris?
I don't know what I've seen with it yet. One of the things about the Osiris, and about SkyHub in general, is they have a very, very strict end user licensing agreement for the data. It doesn't mean that you can't see the data. It just means that to get access to the data, even for me to get access to my own data, you have to register with SkyHub, which I've done, and you have to access it through their portal. What they've done is they've created a system that protects the provenance and protects the integrity of the data, so that if you are an astronomy club, if you're academics or scientific research groups or anything like that, you can get access to the data through registration. But they want to vet you out first. They want to find out who you are, and they want to make sure that they have a good handle on who's viewing it. They don't say no. They just want to know and want to understand who's looking at the data. So I haven't actually dug into anything yet to see if my SkyHub has pulled up anything. And to be honest, I haven't done anything other than some very local investigations around Las Vegas. I've gone up to Rachel, Nevada. I've gone through Area 51. I've camped out on the western side of Las Vegas through Red Rock, or the eastern side out towards Valley of Fire and places like that. But they're not hot spots. Because I am a father of a 7-year-old daughter and I have a full-time 9-to-5. So I need to clear it with my wife, and I need to schedule vacation time, and I need to make sure that I have, all the gear and everything necessary to do an extended investigation. One of the things that I really want to do is get out to Skinwalker and park the Osiris on Skinwalker and turn everything on and sit back and see what I can collect data wise.
That would be really cool. I mean, if you do, hopefully make a podcast on that and put it on your YouTube, because I'll be there. I'll be watching it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm very much looking forward to it. And if I can't do Skinwalker, there are so many other hotspots. I mean, we've got, Palmdale, California, which is home of Lockheed Skunk Works. A lot of people see some crazy things out there, most of which I'm probably pretty sure is Lockheed Skunk Works. In the works. We've got Catalina Island, but the great part about the Osiris is I'm not limited to anything. I mean, I've got access to Canada. I've got access to, 49 of the 50 states. I've got access to, Central America. I can drive into Mexico, with this thing. So, depending on what's happening and time and availability and cash flow, this vehicle can pretty much cover the western part of the world.
Have you heard of Bradshaw Ranch in West Sedona?
No, I have not. Tell me about Bradshaw Ranch.
So it's very similar to Skinwalker Ranch. It doesn't have the same hype, but it has a lot of the same phenomena that happens, like UFOs, cryptids, vortexes, Bigfoot, all that stuff. But it's in Sedona, like, one of these really crazy vortex cities in the United States. I guess it's like a town, but city. Yes. So, and it's nice because it's, one, you're getting the beautiful view, but you're also more in the middle of nowhere. That's not as hyped as Skinwalker Ranch, where you might need maybe a little bit more clearance. But I'm also not too sure on that.
I'm not a person that gravitates towards fame and visibility and signing autographs and things like that. That's not what I want to do. I would much rather go somewhere. It's hard to not recognize the OSIRIS vehicle. I mean, it's a giant Land Rover. It's got alien stickers on the side of it and sensors and camera systems on the roof. It, you know, it's like the modern day Ghostbusters vehicle, but I don't want to try to draw attention to myself when I go do investigations because I want to protect the integrity of the data. So going to places that are not as known is something that I'm very interested in.
Absolutely. So then with the OSIRIS as well, can it look for other cryptids or is it just UAPs? You know, like,
well, it's the vehicle is a tool. And the tool can be used in any way. I mean, you can use a spoon to cut a cake. So it depends on what I want to do with it. You know, I have Geiger counters and tri-field meters, and I have the ADS-B systems. I'm looking at putting an active radar on the vehicle so I can actually have a scope in the car and be able to look and see what type of aerial aircraft are being displayed on the scope and compare that with the ADS-B system that that's already involved in it. You know, when I was working with Lou and Sean, we were talking about some of Jacques Vallée's theories about how to attract the UAP. So one of the other tools that I have is a series of extremely powerful LEDs that are like LED floodlights, but multicolored LED floodlights that I can control remotely or program certain patterns with. Very similar to what the influence that Jacques Vallée had in Close Encounters of the Third Kind with Steven Spielberg is, you know, using the colors and using the sound and the music and things like that, except this is just color projection. So, you know, one of the things that I'm really embracing is the scientific method in everything that I'm doing. So nothing is hard-coded, nothing is static, nothing is unchangeable. I'm looking at this and, you know, making an observation, asking a question about what it is that I'm seeing, forming a hypothesis, making predictions on how I think a test will come out, and then testing the predictions, and then going through the whole iteration process and changing things and retesting and changing my hypothesis and until we come to a valid conclusion on what it is. So, you know, a lot of people have issues with this because they're thinking that this is a manifestation of consciousness or it's quantum entanglement or it's something that cannot be known. And that may well be the case. So if I run, you know, 30 or 40 investigations and I don't get any measurable repeatable data, I have to take a hard look at what I've done here and see if there's a way to change it or if I need to embrace the ayahuasca and the DMT and look at this internally. I have no idea where it's going to lead me.
And because, you know, you're one of the first people creating this OSIRIS, a UAP vehicle, you're giving a lot of people inspiration. I mean, look at the dead gaucho. He's excited. You're the one giving him hope to create a vehicle like this, because I think all of us one day want to probably live in a car. I mean, not like that, but, you know, go and travel, but have all the equipment with them without depending on other people, but without depending on renting equipment when you can just have it and like live with it. So,
well, not only that, it gives us control. You know, for the last 70 years, we have been waiting and waiting and waiting for this government to come out and tell us what the hell is going on.
Exactly.
And, you know, I was in the government. I work as a defense contractor now. So I don't hate the government by any sense of the word. They're the ones that write my paycheck. But I do not believe that any time in our lifetime are we ever going to get disclosure from the United States government. And I fully believe that the best way, the only way that we're ever going to fully understand what is going on in our skies is for the citizens to mobilize and capture the data ourselves. Citizen science is going to show disclosure before a FOIA request does.
I completely agree with the interview with Lou Elizondo that was premiered today. He said the same thing. He said, we shouldn't depend on our government. Sure, we can ask for disclosure. We can ask for these things, but we should go out on our own looking for that information because it's not going to be spoon-fed to us.
Absolutely.
We have to look for it ourselves.
Absolutely, we do. And that really drives the point home that there needs to be a standardization in data collection. We may have experiencers who are much more advanced in their understanding of what is happening, but the population, the worldwide population, or even the population in the United States doesn't have the educational base layer. And we need to go backwards in time a little bit, and we need to lay a foundation down. And we need to be able to show the world that we are observing, that we are testing, that we are predicting, and that we're making, you know, we're not developing an idea and making the test to prove our idea true. We're developing a hypothesis and we're testing our hypothesis to see if it fails or if it holds true. And we have no vested interest in the answer. The only vested interest that we have is in the truth. And we need a data standardization to make that happen. And between SkyHub and the other sensors that are being incorporated into the vehicle, not just for SkyHub, but for redundancy and for data collection that is not yet capable with SkyHub, I'm putting a lot of other tech into the vehicle. I'm truly hoping to be able to show people how to create this. You know, take your dad's station wagon that's been sitting in the barn for the last 20 years and cut holes in the roof and go do this. You know, put a SkyHub in your backyard. But we can't rely on leaks from CipherNet. We can't rely on the declassification of Batman balloon photos, and we can't rely on anything from the government for disclosure, because even if it comes from the government, and even if the government says this is disclosure, we have to take that with a grain of salt, because the government has a vested interest in keeping secrets very close to the vest.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there is a national security aspect. Maybe not to the UAP, but to the government not disclosing what they currently have in their inventory. That is national security. So we can't rely on them to tell us the truth. We have to go get it ourselves.
And that's why we're having these inspiring conversations, having these podcasts, watching these kinds of TV shows like Unidentified Inside America's U.S.
UFO investigation. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say USA investigation. That definitely wasn't right. But you know what I mean. But it's having these conversations that open the mind, not only of ourselves, because we're learning as we interact, but with other people that are listening, that are also placing in the comments and getting their questions answered. We don't need the government when we have our own minds. We have our own ideologies. And you were talking about converting an old Volkswagen, converting all these old cars. And let me tell you, my dream, honestly, is to convert an RV, go on the road, and never come back. I mean, look, as a college student, I don't like living in a tiny apartment. I want to live in even a tiny little car and then drive around and be free, you know? Be free and look at the skies in any location. Because in the big cities, right, you can't look in the sky. You can't look anywhere up. There's nothing.
I grew up in rural West Virginia on a 60-acre horse farm for the vast majority of my life. And then I moved out to Las Vegas in 2015. So I've only been here for, you know, like 5 or 6 years now. And I still, to this day, when I walk out of my house here in Las Vegas and I look up at the night sky, it's depressing because you can't see it. You can't see, I can see the light from the Luxor Pyramid from my house better than I can see Orion's Belt. And that's just sad.
That is. That's got to be like in really, really high altitude without any light pollution to just enjoy a few stars, maybe the moon if you're lucky. Yeah. And that's so disappointing to be deprived of such a beautiful Earth scenery. Well, actually, it's not Earth, it's space. But
sure,
to have that and then not be able to have it.
Well, mankind, humanity, we have invented more things and more processes and advanced more simply because we took the time to look up than when we looked down. You know, our calendars were built on star charts, sidereal times. And, you know, we understood how to calculate the circumference of the Earth based on, you know, shadows of the sun and the moon, coming down through, through tall objects and things like that. So, you know, geometry and trigonometry were born because we took the time to look up, and now we can't see it. And that's just a shame.
No, I completely agree. Michael has a question.
Sure.
And he says, oh, do you want me to read it or do you want to read it?
Let's see. Do you ever feel like the UFO community shoots itself in the foot with some of the unrealistic claims they make? For example, does it do more harm than good to the topic, and what can be done to correct that? Yes, absolutely. And it's coming. I'm probably going to get flamed for this, but I own Kevlar underwears and I'm a big boy, so I can handle it. But the issues come not only from the general population in ufology, but also from quote unquote professionals in this aspect. We grifting and con artistry are rampant, absolutely rampant in this field. And people are out there to make a buck anywhere they can. Now, I'm not going to say that if I could do this full time and pay my mortgage doing UFO research, that I wouldn't jump at the opportunity. But I'm not in this to make money. I'm in this to find answers. And unfortunately, there are people who are in this to make money. I'm not going to name names. I think we all know who they are. People that sell access to information, sell access to experiences, I think are abhorrent. But going back to the root of the question, people that are making wild claims.
What would you classify as wild?
Well, that's a good question, because when we're dealing with this, we don't know what it is. So we don't know what it's capable of. So wild, you know, a wild claim could be wild from somebody who only believes in nuts and bolts spacefaring civilizations as traditional UFO. They might think that a claim of being remote viewing or conscious, non-local consciousness, they might think that is wild. People that think that nuts and bolts craft are the only thing that are out there may look at stories from the Bledsoes and think that, luminous orbs floating through the trees are a wild claim. I also think that a lot of those are probably wild and disingenuous statements. Not all of them. I am personally of the mindset that there are three different things happening that have been lumped into this whole idea of the phenomenon. I think that there are very, very likely to be nuts and bolts spacefaring civilizations that have been here or are passing through here. I also think that there is probably a very good case to argue the ideas of consciousness combined with quantum entanglement theories going all the way through string theories and the fact that maybe humanity can manifest aspects of reality. And then I also think that there are parts of paranormal, the cryptids and ghosts and beasties. But the problem is we've lumped everything into one category. So yeah. The people that believe in ghosts are thinking that the UFO folks are nuts, and the people that believe in UFOs are thinking that the paranormal folks are nuts. And this goes back to data. We need to record the data so we can analyze it, compartmentalize it, and say, okay, this data set belongs to you. This data set belongs to you, and this belongs to this guy over here. And now go and figure out what the hell's going on. But one of my biggest problems is this whole idea of ufology, the whole idea of UFO research. It's been reduced to 240 characters at a time on Twitter. And it's translated across to the way that people are filming the videos. We're never seeing the first 5 minutes of the video. Why was the guy filming the top of the trees? Why was he pointing the camera in that direction? I want to know what happened after it went away. You know, I don't want to see the 18 seconds of something zipping back and forth over a tree line with zero context. I want to see the full video. I want to see everything about it. But people are accepting this as honest to God proof. And it's not proof until we have the full story behind it.
Absolutely. Do you think that the UFOs represent a variety of different phenomena, like interdimensionals, travelers, or energy beings, or the nuts and bolts craft? What you saw in Jordan, was it nut and bolts, or like, what do you think?
So second part of the question first. What I saw in Jordan, I think, was probably nuts and bolts. If you ever listen to any of the other podcasts that I've been on, you know, I've been talking about the fact that I was estimating this thing to be in the 80,000 foot and above altitude range and traveling at faster than hypersonic velocities to be able to traverse horizon to horizon, visual horizon to visual horizon in less than 2 seconds. I don't understand why somebody would manifest something like that. I don't see why poltergeists or paranormal would be at the 80,000 foot range and things like that. So I would believe this to be nuts and bolts. But I do think the first part of the question is that there's not just a bifurcation, but there's a trifurcation of this phenomenon. Nuts and bolts, quantum states, interdimensional, things like that. Probably even down to portals. I think, you know, I had a really interesting conversation, a one-on-one, non-recorded conversation with Colonel John Alexander about 4 or 5 nights ago. He lives here in Vegas as well, and I reached out to him, and we went over to a local tavern and sat down and had a beer and a burger and just had about a 3-hour-long conversation. And walking away from talking to Colonel Alexander for 3 hours, it kind of puts a new perspective on where I'm going with my thought process. But he didn't prove anything to me. It's just his personal experience and his personal beliefs and what he thinks. And I took a little bit of that and I added it to my own personal zeitgeist. But you know, I think that if we ever fully understand what is happening, we're going to learn that the nuts and bolts UFOs that are coming in and out of here, they are probably just as subject to what we think of as the quantum entanglement part or the paranormal part as we are.
So then on that note, what do you think is going on Skinwalker Ranch? What are your thoughts?
I wrote an article on Medium a few months ago about programming reality and my thoughts on being able to take occult symbolism or ancient languages or things like that and use it in a way to affect reality. Not that we're living in a simulation, but maybe we're living in a synthesization. A synthesized reality, which is a possibility. Until it's disproven, it is a possibility. But for Skinwalker, I don't know how, I don't know why, but I do believe that there is probably more than likely an interdimensional aspect to Skinwalker, and I think it would be very similar to a portal system. You know, we've looked at these at Göbekli Tepe, Sedona, some of the indigenous populations in South America, Lake Titicaca, places like that. You know, Graham Hancock is all over those theories, but it has merit. I mean, if you go back into historical records and listen to some of the tales of ancient civilizations, you know, they talk about areas where you can walk through and disappear, or that other things appear as they walk out of it. So the idea of having a portal on this planet, it's not because Star Trek came up with it back in 1967. It's because, you know, there's ancient texts that talk about this from the Sumerian times. So I think it is as possible as anything else until proven otherwise.
There you go. And about ancient knowledge, why do you think in so many cases it has become irrelevant presently? I guess not presently, but since the 1900s onwards.
Why has it become irrelevant?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people just don't find it valid anymore.
We don't study history anymore. The educational system has polluted our thought process to the point where it's not just because we don't study civics or we don't study social studies or American history or anything like that. American history has nothing to do with this. Civics has nothing to do with it. But the fact of the matter that the process of teaching people how to understand history is gone, that is what has occurred. We don't listen to our past anymore. And our past, you know, we're trying to figure out why there is so much lost knowledge. You know, why do we not know how the pyramids were created? Why do we not understand how the statues on Easter Island were created or the why to them? And we're like, you know, it's impossible that we would have lost this knowledge. We can't remember when President Kennedy was shot because we're not taught about it in school anymore. So we're living through a live system of losing knowledge. And I totally believe that humanity is much older and much smarter and much more involved than anybody ever thought of. Well, anybody presently has ever thought of, because we stopped thinking.
Definitely. I mean, now with our phones, computers, internet, all these kinds of things, we don't think. We just believe what we see, what we listen, what we hear on the news and things like this, that we don't really question things for ourselves. And then when we come into this topic about UAPs, into this kind of community, there's a lot of digging you have to go through. There's a lot of picking out what's fake, what's real, and really having to question, having to do your own research to see what to believe in and what to see as completely false. And I think being here, joining this kind of community, because I'm still very new to it, I'm still very young, it requires a lot of outside thinking that you don't learn in school, that you won't learn talking to your regular friends just because they don't ask the hard questions. It does.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of Emanuel Velikovsky, but if you ever go and go to a bookstore or get on Amazon and order one of the Velikovsky books, and you read it. I mean, we're talking, you know, 1940s, 1950s authorship here. It hurts to read. It hurts to read the way that those documents and those books were written, because, you know, it's slightly longer than 280 characters, and it requires attention. It requires a baseline of knowledge to begin with, and we don't. Humanity's lost the baseline. So in this UFO research, we have to standardize our data recording, and we have to be able to lay down that baseline, that fundamental understanding, for everybody else to pick up and build upon.
Absolutely. And like Michael said, critical thinking is an unutilized skill of our time. That we use at all. Instead, we learn how to use a calculator and to press buttons instead of counting on our fingers. And we still get the answer wrong.
Yeah. And Mick West is being drugged through the ringer because he is utilizing critical thinking. Now, I am not going to say that everything that he has, quote unquote, debunked is in fact debunked, but he is putting forth critical thinking. He's coming forward with a different explanation. We cannot blindly accept the fact that this is a UAP or that orb is a UFO. We cannot do that. It will be doing us such a huge disservice, not only individually because of our personal reputations are at stake, but on a human level, because if we accept that everything is, we don't research to actually find out and know.
Completely. And that goes back into the alien topic when figuring out what's fact and what's fiction. Even the things that are fiction, even the things that people are BSing to us, it still creates critical thinking to be like, well, where's the evidence?
Yes.
Let me think about it instead of just taking it in and be like, oh yeah, it's real, when it's not, or vice versa, when it might be not, but it is real. We question it. Well, where's the evidence? How can it be real?
Yes, absolutely. There is more evidence to show that this is advanced technology. And I don't mean anecdotal evidence. I don't mean history, and I don't mean stories. I mean tangible stuff. We have crashed drones. We have we know that stealth drones are bombing Syria. We know that this tech exists. We've seen the RQ-180. We've seen the RQ-170. We've seen hypersonic engines. There are more tangible examples of advanced technology than there are tangible examples of UFO potential. So for us to blindly accept that every strange thing that we see in the sky is UAP or UFO, I think that that's taking the easy way out. If you believe it to be, prove it. Prove it to yourself. Don't blindly accept the answer. Don't blindly look at a photograph or a video and say, oh, that silver thing that's hovering above my neighbor's house, that is absolutely 100% a UFO. Why? Tell me why. Prove it. Find out. Can it be repeated? Can you analyze the photo? Can you analyze the video? What did your neighbor say? Did you even talk to your neighbor? I want all of this data, because if we can't prove it, then we can't educate anybody.
But also in some cases, like certain stories just cannot be replicated. They cannot be repeated. And yet we can only judge our experience, judge our gut feeling that it is real or that it isn't real. So I guess in a lot of cases we want to be scientific, but sometimes we just don't have the opportunity to repeat it.
We can't. You're absolutely correct. You cannot validate an experience without repeatability. The problem is experience in the scientific method being non-repeatable is not valid evidence. It might affect your belief structure, but you cannot expect that your retelling of your experience is going to affect or change somebody else's mind. I don't care if somebody comes to me, let's say somebody was abducted, 100% it happened to them, right? I don't care about their story. It happened to them. It doesn't change how I look at anything, because unless they can bring back a Polaroid of the inside of that ship or show me something that is irrefutable, their description of their experience does not change my belief structure.
So then if you're looking at like regular stories, you know, mythology or things that you hear as a kid, and so a lot of times that forms our ideology of today. Yeah. So which is an example. So then if you were to hear a story about an abduction or someone who encountered an alien, that does not change anything in your mentality.
I'm not going to say that it. One, no. 1,000 of them, sure. Because that's what we're looking at historically, and we don't have the ability to go back in time and validate Ezekiel's wheel. We don't have the ability to go back in time and understand why, you know, there is a Victorian art that depicts UFOs and things like that. We just have to take what we have available to us. But in today's modern age, right here, right now, we have equipment to be able to test and measure and look and see and record. And I think now we have the ability to prove. And that's what I'm trying to do. I want people to go out. And if they live on a farm somewhere where there are constant orbs or constant shadow figures and things like that that are happening, my God, go to Walmart and buy 25 game cameras and hang them on trees. Invite the public to the property, because the public is going to have a Sony A7 camera, which is 1,000 times better than your iPhone 9. You know, open this up and let it be recorded. show the world what's happening, because if we can't record the data, we can't prove anything. Your experience is valid to you, and I'm not going to take it away from you, but you at the same time cannot expect me to accept your experience without being able to have the same experience.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's a valid point. I mean, when talking about science and facts, yeah, data is so important. It's not just experience. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking up into the sky, and you talked about night vision that you have, mm-hmm. What kind of night vision camera, what kind of night vision technology do you use?
Well, back then, I had an ANV PVS 7 Bravo, which was a military-issued dual eyepiece, single imaging tube, zero depth perception set of goggles. And it was amazing for 1995. Today, it would still work. It would still be good tech. But people are looking at digital night vision as a cheap alternative. It's a tool, and it's better than using just your eyes. But if somebody wants to really, really put the time and effort into this, if you can save up $600 for a set of Psionics digital night vision, wait, save up that $600 four times and go get yourself a set of PVS 7 or PVS 14s and get the real night vision. Be patient, get the good tech, because the bad tech is going to produce it's going to produce suspect results.
And have you caught anything interesting using your night vision?
Yes, but nothing that I'm going to go to the public with, because I don't have corresponding data for it, and I'm not going to put my name on anything. I'm not going to publish a YouTube video or 18 seconds on Twitter of something that I don't have data for, that other people can't go through and verify and try to understand what it is.
That's good. That gives you a lot more credibility that you're honest, not only with the public, but with yourself, to give
people are asking
real
me
information.
All the time. Yes, people are asking me all the time, hey, let's see the data that the OSIRIS has come up with. I'm like, no, you're not going to see it until I have something that is worthwhile in seeing. Because if I'm capturing somebody flying a 3D drone, which is one of those competition little helicopters that can fly upside down and left and right and zig and zag and do all these crazy things, if I'm capturing stuff like that on a routine basis, you know, that degrades the value of the OSIRIS in the public's view, but it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. You know, it's finding that and it's categorizing that. But my data that I generate is going to go to the public 100% of the time when I have something that I think is worthwhile for the public to look at.
Well, I mean, you have good ethics and morals to hold information back until you have the proper evidence, which is not necessarily, I wouldn't say like not common, but it's a good characteristic to have, especially in this kind of field.
Yeah.
When you can be ridiculed at any time.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't want to be a sensationalist. I don't want to have a TV show where I am being filmed going from point A to point B, and everything in between is subjective and nothing is hard-coded and nothing is provable. I would love to have a TV show that is filmed over the course of 4 or 5 years and maybe only has 6 episodes in it, because the only thing that is put forth are the things that are worthwhile to see. I don't want filler space.
Absolutely. For young viewers, teenagers, and college students, just getting into the area of interest and want to be part of this mystery, which is obviously exciting, do research. What advice do you have for them?
Get a job, because this doesn't pay anything. Get a job. Get your mortgage. Get your life in order first, because this is a rabbit hole that will suck you in, and it will, you made a point earlier of saying that you wanted to live in a car. If you're right out of college and an RV, if you're right out of college and you jump into this without having your career set up and without having your goals and your financial responsibilities on par first, you're going to be living in a car. Until I can do this and pay my mortgage, my mortgage comes first, and then my investigations come second. So my advice to the younger generation is, don't jump into this until you've solidified your life first. If you want to research ufology, if you want to research UFOs, go into a science-based education. Get a degree, get your master's, get your PhD, astrophysics, quantum mechanics, parapsychology. But get your degree in something so you know at a basic minimum how to write a damn report. And then get a couple paychecks under your belt and then get on Twitter. Because before that, you're not going to do anybody any good.
Brutally honest. I love it. I love it. I have not heard that kind of advice yet for the young viewers. So I think that's very important.
The only reason I know how to write a report is because I was a cop for 12 years in the military and I was trained on how to do it. And I'm a technical writer by trade. So my investigations, reports that I have generated, they have gone to people in the government for review. And the only reason that I can do this is because I was trained in how to do it. And it's my job to write technical reports. But I am not a scientist, so I don't know how to interpret my own reports.
I guess in some cases you don't really have to be a scientist to write a report when you have the basic knowledge of learning how to write any kind of thesis paper. But I mean, for example, I'm in business and a communication major. Mm-hmm. My dad wants me to get a master's degree, but you know. But anyways, working for the debrief has really helped me to not only learn how to do these things, but it also works well with my degree firsthand versus, you know, being in a science degree, just because that can be a little bit extreme, I guess, for some people who are just laymen, right? Jumping into the topic. A lot of us that are in this community are just like normal people. We're not these crazy scientists that have all this information. We're just like, yeah, UFOs are cool. They're real. Let's put it out there and let's get that disclosure going on versus being like, oh, let me measure the soil and all this crazy.
There will be a definitive difference if two people have the exact same sighting and one person is living in a single wide trailer, smoking a Newport, wearing a wife beater out in his backyard and sees something. And the other guy is a senior physicist at Los Alamos and sees the exact same thing. Their experiences are identical, but how they convey those experiences to the rest of us are going to be very different. So, mm-hmm. It's not taking anything away from either of those people. They had the exact same valid experience. It affected them and it affected their life the exact same way. But one is not going to be able as well as the other to communicate that experience and quantify it and measure it and understand and put, like Michael was saying, a critical thinking flair to it. And that does damage to the UFO community because, unfortunately, the folks at Los Alamos who see these things are not coming forward nearly as often as the folks behind the trailer court.
Absolutely. I mean, I think definitely having just the basic knowledge is strong enough to be able to express experiences that are happening. Absolutely.
And I didn't mean to disparage or insult anybody in my descriptions of, but it's a fact of the matter. I mean, you need to be able to be cognizant of how to express the data or the experience that you record.
Yeah, but there's also so many different ways to express it, not just through verbal explanation, not just through writing explanation, but also through artist and visuals as well, sure. Like creating videos and things like this. Like, for example, for the debrief, I produce everything. I do all the video editing, all the graphics, all the filming and all of that. So even though I might not be the best with my verbal words, having those graphics, having the basic knowledge of learning how to use a laptop and to use editing programs, it can still get that point across even better than mm-hmm. possibly having a written thesis paper written for high-knowledge people.
Sure.
And because it also pairs really well with my major, right, of business and communication, and it is my passion yes. to express yes. through not only this channel, but through the debrief and for the generation at large, because I know we're at different generations, and my generation has a lot shorter attention span, like tiny. And mm-hmm. and if it has too many words, no one's going to stay interested. So I think staying up to date with a lot of these things and to make them relevant to today is, I think, can have more validity, not always, but sometimes more validity when it's not just words or using fancy language that not yeah. everyone can understand. You know what I mean?
I think that right now humanity is in a pause because our technology is developing very rapidly, but we have not yet developed the correct technology that allows your generation and the younger generations to be able to communicate in the same way that my grandparents were able to communicate in, with the detail and with the verbiage. And so when AR or VR becomes more prolific and more commonplace, and people have a virtual universe to live in, and be able to communicate through that medium, I think then we may see ourselves with the 400 page digital novels that my grandparents grew up with, presented in a completely different medium. But when we get to that point, I think then the commonplace, the common people, the everyday John Q. Publics will be much better able to express their experiences and to help replicate data.
I agree. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for letting us to get a view on your life and your work. Please tell everyone where they can find you online.
Online is jeremydmcgowan.com is my website. I'm also very active on Twitter, and you can find me at good Lord, what is my Twitter? It's Jeremy Unidenti One. So it's Jeremy Unidenti, Unidenti, and the number one.
Thank you, everyone. Tuned in and stay tuned all together. And I deeply apologize. This is only water, but oh my gosh, it's a green screen, but it's only water. Anyways, thank you everyone that stopped by to watch this really interesting podcast of Shifting the Paradigm. If you guys have any questions, you can always leave your questions in the comments box below. And I will see you guys next week. Bye-bye.